all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good day on a beautiful Sunday in May right here on WAAM Talk 1600. It's Bob Gould, and I got my partner with me today, too, Dale Throneberry. Dale.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, I can tell you that for sure.
Finally,
spring has sprung.
Spring has sprung. But, you know, I wonder how...
Don't put a jinx on it.
It was so darn cold. Anyway, yes, it's a beautiful day, and I want to say welcome back to Nina, and she's waving to everyone, and to Derek, and he gives us the high sign right there. There we go, the thumbs up. We got a great program. You know what's going on? I mean, 70 years ago, the first week of May was the end of the European War. I mean, we're right here. At this
right.
time. And you and I? No, you weren't alive.
I was not alive. Yet.
I was alive.
You were, never mind.
I was alive. And I think it's so fortunate that we could be on the air on the 3rd of May. Everything was happening right that first week of May. This is it. So we have two excellent authors back again, once again. They have been on, we've seen them on the History Channel, on Military Channel, on Discovery Channel, Aerial America, I mean, you name it, Smithsonian.
Who are your guests?
We have Kevin Hemel, there we are, I'll get it, right. Kevin Hemel and John McManus, both authors. Right. We're going to be talking about their books on World War. And you know what, every time that you listen to Veterans Radio, you want to be sure and have a...
pencil or pen and something to write on it, even if it's your own hand.
Yes, because we give all kinds of stuff. Dale, why don't you tell us about something that's happening over at Northville?
Well, this is... it's exciting, but it's really important, too. There's going to be an Agent Orange Town Hall meeting next Saturday, May 9th. At Northville High School Auditorium, beginning registration starts at 7 a.m. and it runs until about noon, 1 o'clock. And what's going to be going on at this town hall is they're going to be talking about Agent Orange and what the ramifications of the Agent Orange, if you were exposed to it. Not just you, but they're talking about it going down up to 7 generations.
Legacy.
And so for those of us that were in Vietnam, or if you know somebody that was in Vietnam, please make sure that they go to this meeting. They're going to find out all kinds of information. They're going to have a lot of people that we've had on this program. I see that Mookie Porter from the Vietnam Veterans of America, Bob Cummings from the Agent Orange Writers, Nancy Switzer, Associates of Vietnam Veterans of America, and there's going to be a panel discussion with Ed Martini, the author of Agent Orange. And this is just so important, and I should go mention that if you know somebody who's the son of a Vietnam veteran, get them there, because it goes down through generations. There's been an unusual number of birth defects from the offspring of Vietnam veterans, even down to grandchildren. And so we got to find out what we can do to solve this problem.
Oh, that's just an anomaly.
It's just an anomaly. I'll tell you what, if you want to go through a similar sensation, go get your local weed killer and spray it on your face.
Spray it on your face, yeah. My neighbor, and he, Vietnam vet, his daughter died last year of neurological disease.
Right, and how old was she? 35, 30?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in that neighborhood?
Oh, yeah. He was Agent Orange. He was blasted.
I was talking to
I mean, there's legacy. There's proof right there.
Oh,
well,
right.
No, Bob, what do you know, man? I mean, no, wait a minute.
Well, no, it's out there.
It's out there.
And I was,
he was heartbroken.
We know at least a dozen people in the local area who've died of Agent Orange-related diseases. And, I mean, the diseases are cancer, there's skin cancer, there's leukemia, there's neurological problems, there's Parkinson's, there's all kinds of things that are becoming presumptive disabilities from their exposure to Agent Orange. So for some of those Vietnam veterans that are out there, this is an opportunity to find out perhaps if you're having issues and problems, you may be eligible for some sort of compensation. And I don't mean that in a bad way at all. You need to go to your VA hospital, get checked out. Maybe they can come up with a reason why you are the way that you
he
are
was
right
heartbroken.
Now physically.
She had neurological disease for over 10 years, and he was zapped in Vietnam. So he,
yeah, you
that's
know,
where he's looking.
It messed with our DNA and our genetic makeup, and you know, we don't know what we're passing down, and we just want to make sure that we can protect our children and our children's children. So
okay,
go to this
one
thing.
More time,
Agent R Town Hall Meeting, May 9th, Northville High School Auditorium. That's on 6 Mile Road in Northville. Registration begins at 7 a.m. It is absolutely free to all veterans, their families, medical staff, and the general public. If you want to register early, you can go to the website vva528.org. That's why you have your pencil, vva528.org. That's the Vietnam Veterans of America. They're one sponsoring the town hall. Be there. We will be there.
Yes, we are.
You get a chance to meet us, and we will be there no matter what. So we're anxious to meet you. And
go to our website to find out, because we're going to have it on internet, our internet radio.
We hope so.
Network, broadcasting, internet, and all that information.
Right. Assuming everything falls into place, we will be recording it also.
Speaking about falling into place, again, this is the 70th anniversary of the VE Day, and in Royal Oak. Now, there's a bunch of these folks all over the country. I don't think Royal Oak, Michigan, and Northville are the only places that are doing celebratory 70th anniversary thing. So look on the internet, look in the newspapers. Here's Royal Oak, Michigan. They are going to have at the World War II Legacy Memorial hosting a 70th anniversary celebration of VE Day on the, where's my date here today? May 8th from 4:30 to 7:30. I'm going to be there.
That's Friday. It's coming Friday, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm going to be there. Oh, yeah, how cool. Russell, I want to thank Russell Levine. By the way, if you have anything else that you want us to broadcast, well, there's nothing better than to let us know. Go to www.veteransradio.net, and there will be all kinds of stuff on how to contact us. Let us know so that we can put this on the air. Good. So that'll take care of that. And here we have something else, and we have Wreaths Across America. I did get an email about that, Wreaths Across America. If you would like to have them help you organize something for this coming Memorial Day or the 4th of July or any day that you want at your memorial or at a cemetery, then I'm going to give it again. It's www.wreathsacrossamerica.org. That's wreathsacrossamerica.org. Just go ahead on that website and all that information, how to contact them. Bill Fortier was on the program. He welcomes your input. He'll help you get something organized. One other thing, you know, there was a time, I'm going back in 50, 51, everybody had a flag on Memorial Day. Everybody.
Yes, they did.
And we sold them in front of the churches. We were the Boy Scouts. We sold them in front of the churches. I mean, it was a mass mob to buy them. I don't see that now. I don't, in my complex where I live, there's 6 flags. Mm-hmm. That's it. So what can we do about all this? Well, we want you to go to, and I'm going to, oh boy. I had this all, well, I'll have to give it to you again next week. I thought I'd have this guy's contact information. I'm sorry, folks. But we're going to have they sent me one of their flag kits. It's really mm-hmm. cool. And it's very affordable. It's like $30, $40. And it's made in America.
Is this Taiwan. Is this the gentleman from Detroit who's
yes.
putting flags up all over Detroit?
Yeah, oh, the kid's great. But I don't have his... Okay. His website, doggone it, it's called the Revolution Flag Group, Revolution okay. Flag Group, but we'll have that next week. Oh, Dale, whoa, get that little iPod out there. There you go, Revolution, and we'll have that before the end of the program. But they've got a nice kit that has the flag, the pole, and the little eagle on the top. It's really cool, and go ahead and do that, folks. Get that. Put that out in front. get your neighbors, buy it for a neighbor, buy it for your kids. Fly the flag. No, it's not because you support the government, because you're an American. Got it? That's right, an American. And we have Memorial Day coming up very shortly. We're going to be right back after this very important message with our guests, Kevin Hemel and John McManus. Don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. I want to be their boy, spread some joy when they take old Berlin. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin. They're going to start a row.
Yeah, well, we want to thank Bing Crosby for that one and the Johnny Mercer Band. There'll be a hot town in Berlin when the Yanks come marching in. Well, you know what? The Yanks always weren't marching into Berlin because there was a time when Germany was running amok in Europe when I don't think we had – my parents were non-interventionists, big time. They weren't –
isolationists, right?
Well, they weren't pacifists. They were – yeah.
Stay away.
You know, stay away. Stay out. But – when Pearl Harbor came and the sirens went off and the gong sound, they were there. And so was a lot of other folks. So I wonder if that had something to do with Hitler's decision to make what I consider one of the big blunders he did. Of course, he made a lot of them, but I mean, big one was to declare war on the United States. Wow, what the heck was he thinking? Tell us about that, John McMahon. That John McManus.
Well, he had a lot of permutations that went into that. He was already actually fighting the U.S. On the Atlantic because the United States was supplying Great Britain and the other allies while claiming to be a neutral. So Hitler sends his U-boats out, his submarines, to try and strangle Britain's lifeline. And he figures in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor that the Japanese have really eliminated most of U.S. naval power, which was the thing, really the only thing that Hitler feared about the United States. So he felt the gloves were off. He could really send his submarines out there to savage the remainder of American shipping, to also strangle Great Britain. And at the same time, he anticipated he would probably finish up the war in Russia within the next year or so, thus having conquered most of the Eurasian, or much of the Eurasian landmass. He would present the British and the Americans with a really untenable situation and never get back to Europe. But he figured also, if it ever did come to it, and American soldiers would face German soldiers in combat, it would be no match for them because he felt that the products of his system would fight better than the products of a democracy.
Well, and he also had a big pond, which is called the Atlantic Ocean, and he probably figured, right? That how are they going to go ahead and have an army that's going to come here? I mentioned that about my folks that he thought we were weak. Comment on that, John.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler, like a lot of racists, is sort of a prisoner to his own misconceptions and prejudices. He felt the United States could never truly be a great power because it was so ethnically mixed. As he once said to one of his key cronies, he said, America is, quote, too negrified and Judaized to ever be a great power. So he felt on that score that the Americans could never match up to the German soldiers, whom he thought of as, of course, racially superior to everyone. But he also thought democracy was an untenable kind of system that was not conducive to fighting wars, that it just led to parliamentary procedure and endless debates that paralyzed a country. And he pointed to France as an example of that. So he kind of underestimates the United States on multiple levels, but he also, I think it's fair to say, had underestimated the American impact on World War One, the war that had really, shaped and transformed him and his life. So in doing that, he wasn't learning from history.
Well, now we, okay, we, I think my next question wants to go to Kevin Hemel, because, I mean, here's General Patton, and Kevin is a Patton biographer and historian, and here's General Patton thinking, man, what was he thinking, Kevin?
During the attack on Pearl Harbor, he was leading tanks in the 2nd Armored Division, and he had been studying this for most of his career, and had been studying the Germans most of the during the war, because they were the ones who really used tanks in an exploitive method. And so I think it was sort of a relief to him, because he was so on edge, like so many other generals and officers in the U.S. Army, on this sort of tentative bubble of will we, won't we go to war. And once Pearl Harbor is bombed, it kind of clarifies everything for him. Now we're at war. Now we can roll up our sleeves and get to work. And then there's some anxiety about that, because he really wants a prominent role in this war, and he doesn't know if he's going to be able to get it. Of course, he does, but at this point of his career, he's leading tanks with the 2nd Armored Division, but very anxious that this war might occur and he might be left out of it. So he is he's greatly relieved when General Marshall, the Chief of Staff, comes to him and says, listen, I need you to take an entire armored division over into the desert and help the British fight. And then Marshall reconsiders and realizes we can't do that. We can send the British tanks. We're not ready to go to war yet in that manner. And Patton is almost heartbroken when this idea dissolves, and he thinks he's done something to offend Marshall. And he promises himself, if another opportunity comes, I'm taking it without any hesitation. He was worried that he hadn't been forceful enough when Marshall offered him the position. But this is well before Operation Torch, well before the United States has the men and armaments to get involved in the war. That's going to take a bit of a build-up, because Roosevelt has decided not to do any great military build-up short of, you know, having a draft, because the American people are so worried about getting involved in a war that they think Roosevelt wants, but it's really that the Japanese and the Germans that pull the trigger and put us into this war.
Well, so here we have the United States with the big pond, okay, and we had submarines that were essentially having a quarantine, a blockade. So that's not going to, we're not going to be sending troops over there, not right away. And what carried the load were the bombers for almost 3 years, the bombers, and that was what our contribution was to the war effort. And Bomber Harris from Britain says, I can, I'll try to get my British accent. Hey, mate. No, that, well, anyway, he said, I can make this happen. We'll bomb them into submission. Professor McManus, tell us about that. Did it work?
No, it doesn't work. Certainly the strategic bombing campaign damages Germany severely. And, you know, more importantly than anything else, it eliminates the German Air Force as a major threat to the invasion of Europe that takes place in 1944. But the original American concept and hope is to fight this war at distance with air power and perhaps sea power. And this continues 70 years later. That tends to be our first option. And unfortunately, wars tend to be fought and won really on the ground. So the war in Europe is similar to that the American policymakers are going to have to figure out. They're going to need a lot of ground combat manpower. So for about the first year to a year and a half of the war, a lot of the American contribution was tied up in four-engine bombers, the famous B-17s, of course, and B-24s, flying from England in round-the-clock bombing along with the RAF. And the hope was for the U.S. Army Air Force to prove itself as a kind of a war-winning weapon that would earn independence for the Air Force, which, of course, it ultimately gets after World War II. Bomber Harris and the Royal Air Force, of course, had seen their own cities bombed, in 1940 and 41, and were very eager to get back at the Germans, but also, you know, the British understood they didn't want a manpower-intensive, bloody campaign on the European continent. They'd been through that in World War I, and they would have hoped to avoid it. And if air power could do that, then great. So you had these kind of air power prophets who were promising big results, but could not quite produce them, and of course, ultimately, a tremendous amount of ground fighting had to be done.
If I could just add something real quick, General Patton used to say that air power cannot hold ground or take prisoners, And those are two valuable things that ground armies can do that, you know, air fleets just cannot do.
Did we have the Sherman, Kevin?
We were developing the Sherman. We had something before that called the Lee, which the British called the Grant tank, that could not support a big heavy cannon in a turret. So they put the 75 millimeter in the body of the tank on the right side, so you lose a lot of maneuverability, and then you put a 75 caliber heavy weapon on the top turret, and that's we get the Sherman just in time for the major battles in North Africa. But we were really relying on a less than reliable tank early on. Now most of the British and the Russians mostly fought with the Grant. We were using it as we came into North Africa, but it was rapidly replaced by the Sherman, which is going to carry the army through the rest of the war. It's going to start off as not the most ideal tank, but we upgrade it as the war goes on so that it can meet German medium tanks toe-to-toe. And eventually it does have a fighting chance against some of the heavier tanks, the later what's called the EV-8 Sherman, where they upgraded the cannon so that it could at least fight a Panther and a Tiger, if not, you know, even though it was slightly less than what the Germans had.
Okay, folks, they have to solve that little problem of submarines, wolf packs in the Atlantic. They did, and we won't get into that now. Nope, I want to keep going on to the land war, but they did solve that. They were able to close the famous black gap. That was where we didn't have anything. We weren't able to protect our convoys, and of course we couldn't be sending troops over there until we had that all straightened out. But we did. We had that all taken care of, and now we were able to start sending equipment over because they were going to do something. And I think it was Stalin who wanted, let's open up another front. Let's open up another front. And there was a lot of pressure on, well, who was going to make that decision, John?
Ultimately, it's really the Americans who are going to make that decision, because if such an invasion can happen, and the only reason it can happen is that the United States is prepared to take the lead, and it takes the better part of about two and a half years for that to come to fruition. So quite understandably, Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union, who are really facing about 80%+ of the German army in 1942 and suffering most of the losses, and that'll be true through most of the war, want the Western Allies to relieve some pressure on them by opening up what Stalin feels is a second front, and to him that means a bona fide invasion of Northern Europe, you know, probably France. So until that happens, he thinks that the Western Allies are not quite holding up their end of the bargain, which isn't entirely fair because the aerial campaign was quite massive and did tremendous damage to Germany. But, you know, initially the Americans, too, wanted that second front. They wanted an invasion of France in 1942. And it's the British who really have to dissuade them and say we're not prepared for that yet, which was correct. They didn't control the sea. They didn't control the air. They didn't have enough landing craft. They didn't have enough trained troops, enough manpower for the campaign that would follow, enough logistics. I mean, you name it, they didn't have enough. So the British persuaded the Americans to pursue a Mediterranean strategy, the invasion of North Africa that Kevin had mentioned earlier, and then, of course, there'll be subsequent invasions of Sicily and Italy. That'll play out in 1943 and 44.
Okay, we're getting close to the halfway mark, and I want to go. At this point now comes another big event that one of Bob's list, and that's the invasion of Europe. Now, oh, wait a minute. We could have come in from Italy. Whoa, we could have done that and could have not had to have any mulberries or any of that other business. There were ports. We had control of the country. We could have come up from the south and not going into Normandy. And John McManus, who wrote the book, The Dead and Those Who Are About to Die, the story of D-Day and Omaha Beach. John, what was going on there? We had everything going through Italy. Why didn't they do that?
Well, they tried. Churchill's great hope was that you could find a back door into Europe, what he will eventually describe as a soft underbelly of the crocodile, that by invading the weakest of the Axis partners, Italy, you could knock Italy out of the war. You could then have some influence in the Balkans, you know, obviously, which is bordering Italy, and you could find a backdoor route into Germany, into southern Germany, and perhaps get air bases, too, from which to bomb Hitler's empire. Well, really only the last happens. The Allies invade Sicily in the summer 1943, and of course, Patton has a huge role in that particular invasion. and they subsequently invade the Italian mainland at Salerno in September of 43, and these operations that follow go next to nowhere. The Allies were stalemated throughout most of 1944. They don't get Rome until June 4th, 1944, which, of course, is 2 months before D-Day. And so Italy ends up as a kind of stalemated, tragic sideshow. And Churchill had always hoped it might develop into more. But by 1944, it's clear the Americans have said, we are going to pursue a cross-channel attack. This must be done. The British have acquiesced to this, too. So once that happens in June 1944, Italy becomes a kind of a forgotten backwater. So they're never really able to get through. But the one thing that was productive about Italy was the capture of major air bases from which to bomb targets in Europe. And that was substantial.
You know, and you don't hear too much about that. I mean, the air bases that I've has all been from England. So we were launching attacks. That's the first time I've heard this. On Germany from Italian.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, the Allies capture a series of really good airdromes around a place called around southern Italy. A whole series of bases that the Italian Air Force had built.
Is this Foggia, John? You're talking about?
Say again.
Is that Foggia? Or Foggia?
Yeah, Foggia, exactly. And then also Bari, too. But so the RAF and the 15th Air Force, U.S. 15th Air Force, are going to have major raids there for the rest of the war, including, you know, the really important ones at the Ploiești oil fields in Romania, which will be hit many times.
Okay, folks, we've got about 15 seconds before the halfway mark. We'll be right back. You listen to Veterans Radio, right here on Talk 1600 WAAM. Don't go away. John and Kevin and Bob and Dale will be right back. May is Military Appreciation Month, and this May, Conway Truckload is introducing True to the Troops, a new initiative to help military veterans find exciting career opportunities as professional drivers. Conway Truckload honors veterans and respects the values they stand for. After all, teamwork and dedication are values that have made Conway Truckload a leader in the transportation industry. For more information about driving opportunities at Conway Truckload, visit TrueToTheTroops.com or call 866-WORK-FOR-US.
If you ever go down Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
Yeah, working for the Yankee dollar. Well, that was the Andrews Sisters, Rum and Coca-Cola, one of the many, many tunes during World War II that was also part of the war effort. If you weren't fighting, you were fighting in your own way. And the Andrews Sisters, Bing Crosby, Johnny Mercer, Gene Krupa, the Dorseys, they all contributed in their own way. We have with us both authors, and I want to give a little background. I know, and I jumped right in, but that was a reason for that. One of our guests today, John C. McManus, is professor of history, military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. He's written many books on World War II and also served as a member of the editorial board of World War II magazine. And also Kevin Hemel, who is known as a historian for the U.S. Army's Combat Studies Institute. Ooh. Boy, they do it. Yeah.
Sounds official.
That's really cool. they write military history narratives on the war in Afghanistan and all kinds of good stuff. He also, Kevin, is the author of Patton's Photographs and Patton, legendary World War II commander. Right now, before we get right back with John, Kevin, what did Patton think about attacking Germany from the south, coming up through Italy instead of Normandy? What did he think about that?
Well, his main focus was not as much the campaign in Italy as its commander, Mark Clark, who he was very unimpressed with, didn't think he was going to be very aggressive. Patton, of course, had led the American 7th Army in Sicily, and that was the first time we had an entire army, a large enough force, to fight, and his job really was a defensive one to protect the flank of Field Marshal Montgomery, or I guess General Montgomery at the time, while he pushed up the eastern side of Sicily. Patton took the initiative, kind of just blasted his way north, very aggressively, plowing over German and Italian defenders, reaches the city of Palermo and effectively cuts the island in half, and then turns east, and this is where the Germans put up a very strong defense. And what he does, he had been planning this even before he reached Palermo. He basically forms his own navy and outflanks the enemy three times, just hopping behind them using amphibious forces of the 3rd Infantry Division, and really kind of outsmarts the Germans, refuses to play by their rules, and kind of goes off the map in order to win the campaign. And when you sort of look at it, you know, Montgomery just drives straight north, and Patton goes sort of northwest and then east and covers twice as much territory as Montgomery and captures the key city of Messina in the process. And this is a huge victory, not just for Patton, but for the American soldier, because the Germans and the British and even the Russians were looking down on American forces after the bloody nose they received at a place called Kasserine Pass in North Africa. And the belief was that the Americans weren't tough enough to really, you know, engage the Germans on the modern battlefield, and Patton proves all of that entirely wrong. You know, the American soldier properly trained and led is going to achieve as well, if not better, than his adversaries and his allies. So Patton really proved himself in Sicily, but he was not impressed with Mark Clark, nor with what Mark Clark was doing in Italy. He said he was taking it too slow, he wasn't thinking out of the box, being creative, and you know, he just didn't think we were going to even reach Rome by 1944. He thought it was such a dead campaign.
Well, okay, folks, now we got to have a decision has to be made. And here is Stalin really pushing for another front to come from the Western Allies. The problem in the Atlantic has been neutralized, put it that way. And so now we decided to invade Europe. And we did it through Normandy. Professor McManus wrote the book, The Dead and Those Who Are About to Die, D-Day, The Big Red One, The Omaha Beast. But we can also call upon Professor McManus to give us some background. What's this all about? They're going to Normandy, a huge, huge logistical fuel, supplies, men, uniforms, food. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, certainly it's a vast undertaking. It's years in the making. It requires pretty much, you know, the entire sinews of two great industrial nations, Great Britain and the United States. But also, we tend to overlook the role of the French Resistance, also the Canadians, Poles, Belgians, Dutch. It's a multinational effort, but there's no question that the United States is really going to be the leader of this coalition, and that's why Dwight Eisenhower is chosen to be the commander of what is known as Operation Overlord.
So who chose him?
Overlord is obviously a huge naval operation, a huge aerial operation, but in the end it comes down to whether the amphibious troops you put ashore on the invasion beaches in Normandy and, of course, the airborne forces, glider and parachute, that you drop into Normandy are going to be able to succeed in overwhelming the German defenses that they've worked on for the better part of several years. But I will say, fortunately for the Allies, you know, the Germans had slacked off. I mean, they've been really quite distracted by the Eastern Front, as you could understand. And so they're really working to the last minute in 1944, beefing up, you know, the pill boxes, the bunkers that you see at the beaches, and the, improving the quality of their defenses. So the concept is to overwhelm them with massed firepower on multiple beaches and multiple fronts. And though it's costly, about 10,000 casualties, this ultimately does succeed, and it's a key moment in the war, of course.
Where did you find most of the material for your book?
Well, for this particular book, I focused on the 1st Infantry Division, which is one of the two divisions that assault Omaha Beach on D-Day and was heavily combat experienced from the battle in Sicily and also in North Africa. So the Big Red One Museum, not too far from you, this is in Chicago, Illinois, in Wheaton specifically, it's just an incredible treasure trove of first-hand material, first-hand accounts, after-action reports, letters, diaries, and the like. Of course, the National Archives has a tremendous amount of material. You know, people I'd spoken with over the years or corresponded with that I'd collected and gathered over the years. It was, and of course, personal visits. which was quite helpful too, figuring out where things happened and what happened. And what I wanted to do was bring the soldier story to life about what it would have been like to be a young guy who was involved in that invasion 70-some-odd years ago that helped decide the course of history, but all they're hoping to do is survive that day.
And they were citizen soldiers, folks. I read Ambrose's book on D-Day, and he made a claim that the casualty rate beginning on the 6th of June till the end of the war in Europe in May of 45, that there was over 240% casualty. Now, that means that a lot of those guys you saw on those ships didn't make it. Is that true?
Well, it depends on the unit. You know, there are some rifle companies, there are some infantry regiments, and it's usually the infantry that takes the heaviest casualties. There are some that, of course, have enormous turnover, and you have percentages even higher than that, 400, 500%. But as far as the overall, you know, American contribution to Eisenhower's forces, fortunately, the casualty numbers are much lower than that because most are non-combat support troops, or even if they are combat troops, are not quite taking that level of casualties. But I will say this, if you were a D-Day veteran, you know, of the 1st Division or the 29th, the 4th Division, whatever assaulting division we happen to be talking about, and you were still upright and fighting about 6 weeks later in Normandy, you were a fugitive of the law of averages because the casualties did tend to be high in your particular unit.
Okay, so now we're at Normandy. Oh, and by the way, you have an event coming up, I believe, on the 5th for your book. Is it coming out in paperback?
Right. The Dead and Those About to Die will be released in paperback on May 5th and should be available in any Barnes & Noble, or anywhere books are sold, actually, but also Amazon.com. You can go through my website, www.johncmcmanus. And it's also available still in hardcover and also in electronic format and in an Audible format, too.
That's way cool, way cool. Let's get back. Kevin, okay.
Yo.
He's yo. And there's Patton. Cooling his heels, but he was a stalking horse, right? I mean, there he is in England, and the Germans all thought he was going to lead. He didn't. Tell us about that.
Sure. This was an Allied plan called Operation Fortitude, and what they realized is, you know, wherever they attacked along the coast, and of course Normandy is the target, the Allies have to do everything they can to make the Germans convinced it's not going to be Normandy. So what they do using turn spies and radio communications is they create this sort of narrative that Patton is going to command the first U.S. Army group and invade a place called Pas-de-Calais. And the Germans will then concentrate all of their forces in that area expecting Patton to invade. He actually had a very small role in it. He traveled over to the area where the army was, you know, supposed to launch one day. And any time he was in London and he saw fellow officers, he'd say, hey, see you in Pas-de-Calais. But other than that, he would spend his time training his army, preparing Third Army for once it became active in France for that famous race across France. But I was just recently looking at some materials. 10 days after the invasion, the Germans were planning a counterattack. And the word came down that two of their armored divisions were being pulled out and sent to Calais. So here they were ready to counterattack mostly the British and Canadian beaches. And word comes down from higher up saying, no, 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 we've got these intercepts. Patton's coming in Pas-de-Calais. We've got to take some of your armor away. And so just the name Patton is strong enough that it's going to influence German decision-making exactly the way the Allies want it. And although he didn't do anything, it was a powerful weapon, just his name.
I happen to love the guy. I really love the guy. You know, and when you and I in our past conversations, you wrote the book about photographs of Patton. Folks, when you see photographs of Patton or movie, film, whatever, look very carefully and you'll see the camera. Yes, he had the camera with him. Oh, you'll see binoculars and you'll see the camera around his neck. He took it with him. Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, you know, I think that was extraordinary about him that, you know, here you've got a general on a battlefield where so many are worried about communications and attacks and defenses, and he's got a camera hanging from his neck ready to capture images. I mean, he's that confident about what he's doing on the battlefield that he can, you know, take a little time off and do some picture taking. And this is a way of you know, showing what his army's doing. He takes pictures of ancient ruins. He has such a passionate history, fascination with history. And he, you know, takes pictures of his dog, you know, whenever it's near a German tank or something like that. I mean, this was an active hobby he is pursuing during the entire war. And I just think it really speaks to his confidence and his generalship that he can do this while he's leading his armies. And it's a treasure trove for historians trying to get inside his mind and understand his leadership.
And you captured all that in your book, Patton's Photographs. Tell us about that. How did you have to get special permission, or how did you find all these?
Well, as every great historian would have to admit, total fluke. I was researching something else on General Patton at the Library of Congress Manuscripts Division, and I was going through a finding aid of all of his materials, and it suddenly listed photo albums. So I ordered them from the stacks, and they brought them out to me, and I started looking at these photos. There were these huge, like, coffee table-sized books. And I realized I was looking at photos of Patton or of areas where he was that I had never seen before. And that's when it dawned on me I was looking at the photos he had taken himself. And so with the permission of the Library of Congress, my friend Bob Knutson, the photographer, came in, and we shot the photographs out of the albums. And I only selected what I thought were the best that really told the story, because he took multiple pictures of the same topic. And so I figured I'd take the ones that I thought told the story of Patton better than any of the other pictures, and condensed it. There were 11 photograph albums altogether, and so I had to condense this into a single volume book. But it, you know, if you want to know what Patton was thinking in World War II, well, look at what he saw. I mean, you're looking at exactly what he's looking at through his eyes, and that's, you know, something that every historian actively pursues with the people they study, is what were they thinking? What did they see? What was their angle of vision? And here Patton had captured it all and stored it away for future historians. It's a great gift.
The American Army pulls it together. They're marching eastward. They're marching through France. They're getting ready to go into Belgium. And then something happened, which I want to say, every war has an Alamo. What was the Alamo in World War II, Professor McManus?
Well, there are a lot of Alamos, but I think one that you could identify as such is the Battle of the Bulge, which is, of course, much later than Normandy, when Hitler feels that he's backed up into a corner and he's retreating on all fronts, and he decides he's going to have a counteroffensive in order to try and turn the political tables around. So he launches a surprise attack under the cover of bad winter weather in the Ardennes, which is sort of the central part of the Allied front at that point. It's very thinly covered. And this leads to what is the biggest American battle in the European campaign, which we tend to call the Battle of the Bulge. It's sometimes called the Ardennes campaign.
Well,
go ahead. Yeah, it leads to really the final demise of the German army, but it cost something in order of about 90,000 U.S. casualties, which is just staggering to think of. But it's a story of initial surprise, but ultimately just incredible resilience. Take on what were the most potent forms of units of the German army that were remaining at that stage, and to do so under incredibly adversarial circumstances. The Bulge lasted about 6 weeks, from mid-December until about the end of January 1945.
Now, it's wonderful about this program is that we can ask people like yourself who know this stuff, and I don't believe, that could have changed World War II. No, I don't believe that had the Americans succumbed at the Ardennes Forest, that it would have been suing for peace and Germany would have had the upper hand. I don't believe that. Tell us about that, Professor McManus.
Yeah, this was always unlikely, certainly. But I think what Hitler is thinking about is trying to cause divisions in the Allied coalition. I mean, he's kind of anticipating the Cold War, understanding that the British and the Americans have little in common with the Soviet Union, and there's a lot of tension there. And he's hoping to kind of give them enough of a bloody nose to reconsider their options and decide whether they really want to go in and conquer Germany alongside the Soviets and then risk the possibility of Soviet domination of Eastern Europe and other portions of Europe. And he was also... he's kind of aiming at the Churchill government, too, knowing the British war weariness, knowing that the government was a wartime government, it could fall from power, Roosevelt had been safely reelected, you know, just a couple months before the bulge, so that option wasn't available to him there. And obviously he couldn't have known that FDR was soon to die in April 1945. So, yes, it was always a long shot, but he was probably going to lose the war anyway, and this was at least one last roll of the dice. And there's one thing about Hitler. He's really a gambler. He never shrinks from risk, and a lot of times he had prevailed in his previous career, so he had faith in himself.
Well, gambler or nuts? I mean, which way do you go? To somebody to make some of the decisions that he made certainly kind of makes you raised eyebrows. So I might beg to say that he just was crazy, just plain old crazy to do. I mean, the generals themselves were going, what's going on here? What they relied so much on their surprise, on their attack, on their supplies, and to get that Panzer Army to push through, and it wasn't there, right? Is that true? All the supplies?
Oh, right. There are some supplies. You know, the supply depots, certainly the most famous element of this is the gasoline that they hoped to capture, because they didn't have a whole lot, and that's a byproduct of the aerial campaign that had, you know, really gone against Germany's fuel producing capacity. So yeah, it really, it's a major long shot, and it's certainly, when we look back 70 years later at Hitler's thought process and his beliefs, and I mean, certainly he's not a rational actor in any way or shape or form, but he's very clever, and he's very resilient, and he's very, very persuasive to many of those around him, unfortunately. And believe it or not, you know, even as of 1945, you know, the mainstream thought in the German military was still a great deal of loyalty to him personally, even after all these screw-ups and lousy decisions, as you've mentioned.
But he was stoned every day. He had meth. He had heroin. He had cocaine. He was injected daily throughout the day. I don't know. It sounds to me like this guy was way off the charts. And so we have the Battle of the Bulge was finished. The American Army did prevail because supplies did run out. Piper left his tanks with empty gas tanks, turned around and walked away. And here we go. It's January 1945. And here's Patton, the commander. What is he? Does he want to take over? Does he want to go into Berlin? We're talking Patton. Go into Berlin and say, I am now the chancellor. Does he want to do something like that, Kevin?
Yeah, he kind of wants to do it all. Part of it is just hyperbole. You know, this is what he tells the men, to motivate them and to get them excited, because they've been through such a grueling war. And a lot of soldiers said, you know, some of it worked on them, and others said we were just too exhausted for Patton's, you know, exclamations and what he was going to do to Hitler when he got his hands on him. But I'll tell you a little almost unknown story about Patton in January of 45. While they're closing up the bulge, the troops come to the Sur River, and Patton wrote his wife that he had crossed it on a small infantryman's bridge, stepping over dead bodies. But I actually found three eyewitnesses, and this actually made it into the press, and Patton never said a word about this, but he came across a group of engineers from the 4th Infantry Division trying to build a treadway bridge across the Sur River, and it was snowing and there was ice in the river, and one of the engineers came to Patton. He said, what's wrong? He said, sir, there's just too much German artillery firing on the river. We can't do this. We can't build this bridge across the river. Patton takes off his belt with the ivory-handled pistols. He takes off his coat, takes off his uniform, and in his underwear, gets in the river, swims across to the other side, swims back, and says to the engineer, I'm sorry, what's the problem here? And with that, they build the bridge. This is January 19th. This is the kind of leader Patton is. And it was kind of a rumor that was out there. It had been out there for almost 70 years. But I was able to find three eyewitnesses that saw this and wrote about it. And that, I think, crystallizes the kind of man Patton was.
Oh, what a guy. Gosh, Dale, say something, Dale. I know. What do you think?
What a guy. Well, you know, if I can do it, why can't you?
That's
exactly.
You
know, that's what a good leader is. You don't tell people to do it. You lead by example.
Right. That's true leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
a little bit of an ego, but, you know.
Hey, Eagles win.
Whatever it takes, whatever it takes.
Eagles win. Eagles win wars. Okay, here we go. We got 5 minutes, Chris. I'm going to get this in. All right. So, all right. Now we're he's moving. We're talking Patton. Patton. They're equidistant to Berlin from the Russians. They're about the same distance away. And Patton gets sidetracked. He goes north. What happened there? Real quick.
Well, he actually was told to head north. He was nowhere close to Berlin, but behind the enemy lines, his son-in-law was in a POW camp, and he, because he realized he's no longer going to be heading directly at it, sends an armored task force to go rescue him, and it's a huge disaster. But Patton survives it, and I actually interviewed one of the soldiers that was on this rescue mission, and I said, you know, did you ever think of saying something, of complaining that Patton was just trying to save his son-in-law? And he said, yeah, I thought about it, but I thought he was such a good general. If I did that, the war would last another 6 months. And that by leaving General Patton in command, the war ended faster than it would have. Now, he never really was close to Berlin. His army was too far south. But he was the driving force by the end of the war. In fact, Eisenhower even sends him further south because of the rumors that Adolf Hitler's got a readout where he's going to try to survive past the war in southern Germany and Czechoslovakia, but that turns out to be just one of Hitler's fantasies that never really occurs, but that sends Patton into what eventually could be Czechoslovakia, and that's where Patton is going to be on the last day of the war, in Czechoslovakia.
Okay, here we go. The last days of the war, the rats are all deserting. Himmler shaves off his mustache and tries to hide with some of the fanatical troops, and he gets discovered. My gosh, he had a vial of cyanide in a glass. What do you call those? The glass little
vial.
Well, yeah,
like
there's a
capsule.
Capsule there. John, where did he hide it? He was naked.
He hid it somewhere on his person.
No. I
don't go that far.
No. I was thinking. I heard tooth. He had it in a tooth. Is that true?
I have not heard that. This is Kevin. I've noted that that's what a lot of people thought with Hermann Göring, but with Himmler, he was being interviewed by British intelligence officers, and I believe one turned his back on him. When he turned back, he bit down on that capsule and just collapsed on the floor. His mouth foamed up. But where he stored it, I don't know. John, do you have an idea?
No, I mean, I've heard the tooth thing, too. I've also heard other more colorful stories. So,
right. We don't, right. So,
might have tasted really bad.
Okay, we only got 2 minutes. Doggone it. I wanted to get a little bit more into this because Germany surrenders, right? Well, it's not like everybody goes to work the next day. Who's in charge the next day? John.
Well, Karl Dönitz had taken over for Hitler after Hitler commits suicide. Dönitz was the head of the German Navy, and so he was technically the German head of state. But once he unconditionally surrenders, now basically the Allies own this mess that is Germany. And they had jointly agreed on occupation zones, which purely, in my opinion, makes the Berlin battle pointless, because you're going to have joint occupation zones there, too, and it's going to be deep within the Soviet zone as well, and that's precisely what happens. So at that point, you have on your hands, arguably, almost as big a mission ahead of you, dealing with a huge human catastrophe and rebuilding, dealing with displaced persons, freed POWs, freed prisoners of concentration camps, not to mention the German people, demilitarizing Germany, disarming them. I mean, it's unreal, and I think it's kind of unfortunate that the accomplishments of Eisenhower and some of the other key generals in this phase of the war, civil affairs, what we think of, which, of course, has a great bearing on our own 21st century wars, but sometimes that's overlooked. I think there's good lessons to learn in the way they operate.
Wow, we got less than a minute. Kevin?
Yes.
John? Yes, Kevin, I love your enthusiasm. John, I love your somber and sober approach to the history here. Both, I'm going to do this again. Is that all right, Dale?
That's fine.
Why not?
Well, we got to find out what these guys did after Germany surrendered, because there's so, as John pointed out, I think that's an important story.
They burned Piper.
Where did this come from?
I got to talk about that. Thank you very much. We'll be talking
next week. Next week is Mother's Day.
Oh, that's right. And you're going to be right here. Until then, you are dismissed.